Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Welcome to our series about the King Ranch on the Western Magazine Hour, as written by Texas Monthly. Here's your narrator, Jack, as we continue.
Holding the family together. The stock of the King Ranch Corporation was distributed to the family in 1954. For the first time, the five children of Alice King and Robert Kleberg were free to dispose of their shares as they wished. It was like the partition after Henrietta's death on a smaller scale, though this time four of the five branches chose to stay in. But Bob's sister, Alice Kleberg East, even more of a fundamentalist rancher than her brother, decided to exchange her shares for part of the ranch. To her and her children, the King Ranch had become too civilized under Bob Kleberg. As they put it, there were too many flower pots to water. They had little patience with the thoroughbred program and with Bob's foreign ventures. The Easts wanted to run their own affairs. But Bob Kleberg had not taken over Captain King's ranch to preside over its dissolution. He was adamant. He would not give up part of the ranch. Luckily, his cousin Richard King and his family were ready to stop ranching and devote their attention to banking and other urban interests. So Bob engineered a trade that gave Richard King's Santa Fe property to the King Ranch in return for 10% of the entire ranch's oil royalties. Bob then traded the Santa Fe to Alice for her stock. Once again, he had used oil to hold the ranch together. In 1958, with the original lease running out, the ranch and Humble negotiated an agreement that would change the course of the ranch's history and, in the 70s, become a bitter bone of contention. The new agreement extended the Humble lease and granted Humble the right to build on the ranch, only 8 miles west of the Santa Gertrudis headquarters, what was then the world's largest natural gas processing plant. In return, Humble agreed to pay the ranch a 1/6 royalty on all gas and oil, instead of the customary 1/8. By 1969, the ranch was producing, Fortune magazine estimated, $120 million a year in oil and gas, making it 1/6 share worth $20 million, or about 15 times the profits from the entire ranching operation. Wealth in those proportions could have turned the Klebergs into stereotypical Texas oil men, the jet rinks whose roots were swept away in the flood of oil. They could have become mad eccentrics or idle rich who frittered away their birthright. Instead, Bob Kleberg took the oil money and sank it into what the family knew best, more ranching. Millions of dollars went into Australia, Africa, South America. He was consumed with the idea of claiming as productive ranch land the deserts and jungles of the tropics and claiming them using his own invention, Santa Gertrudis cattle. Bob Kleberg was convinced that with proper management, the Santa Gertrudis could feed the poor people of the tropics. In the space of 20 years, with an intense expenditure of energy, will, ingenuity, and money, he added 8 million acres to the ranch, mostly under long-term leases. He never stopped acquiring new pastures. In his late 70s, he was absorbed with Spain and Morocco, and when he died, he was obsessed with winning for ranching the world's biggest wilderness, the Amazon. It was one of the most impressive bursts of creative energy in the history of American enterprise, and it made him a world figure, the confidant of presidents and kings. Bob Kleberg took over the ranch during World War I and gave it up as the last troops left Vietnam. He came in with the Model T and went out after the final Apollo mission to the moon. It's not hard to see why he might have seemed intolerant of suggestions from the younger members of the family, his daughter Helenita says. After all, even if they were 50 years old, he had been running the ranch since before they were born. In the last years of his life, he took his grandchildren on tours of the foreign ranches. They rode horseback all day and spent a good many evenings around the campfire. Bob Kleberg wanted more than anything to give his grandchildren a sense of who they were, wanted them to see the vastness of what their family had wrought. And he had decided to charge them with a weighty responsibility, just as Captain King, on his deathbed, had made his family swear never to sell a foot of the old Santa Gertrudis. One night, as the campfire nickered, he gave them their mission. "Do what you can with the ranch," he said, "but above all, keep the family together." In 1974, scarcely a month after he had been working cattle on horseback, he died. The Hard Worker. Though Bob Kleberg transformed the ranch, he did not have the same effect on the family. As Bob grew beyond the ranch, many members of the family found him increasingly remote. The man who most influenced the family was not Bob, but his nephew Dick, Richard's son. Dick was not the brilliant rancher Bob was. He did not seek new empires or command the center stage or extend the frontiers of ranching. He dedicated himself instead to husbanding what his forebears had built. Some members of the family were most inspired by Bob's vision and dominating presence. Others believed in Dick's loyalty and sense of teamwork. Dick's proteges, and not Bob's, would end up running the ranch. Dick was born out on the Laurelis division in 1916. Even before his father died in 1955, he had become his uncle's right-hand man. Dick was the first person Bob thought he could trust with the ranch, and he laid the weight of its responsibility on Dick's shoulders while he embarked on the worldwide expansion that occupied the last 20 years of his life. There was never any doubt that Bob Kleberg was the boss, but it was Dick who kept the ranch going. He worked long hours every day, sweating, sunburned, choking with allergies. He chain-smoked and drank rivers of coffee, and, like many of the men in the family, too much whiskey. He worked the ranch's 825,000 acres as if he were the only hand on a family farm. No detail escaped him. No job was too small to take him out to the ranch. He never took a vacation with his family. Like Richard Kleberg Sr., Dick subordinated himself to Bob. Richard had been content to let his younger brother, Bob, have the attention, the acclaim, and the power. And he did that because he knew Bob was better at running the ranch than he was. That pride in putting personal ambition and fame aside for the best interests of the family sustained Dick also and won him the hearts of his own family and of the Vaqueros, who loved him, perhaps more than any other Kleberg before or since. They loved him in the vigor of his youth for his humor and his cowboy skills, and they loved him later when he lay helpless with emphysema, with instinctive empathy for his suffering. For in the end, Dick Kleberg's body was not up to the burden he placed upon it. Living and working at the pace Bob set could not have helped his health, and South Texas is one of the most hostile climates known to man. Its heat is more enervating than Death Valley's. The air is heavy with humidity, laden with dust, filled with pollen. Almost all the Klebergs are fair, with delicate skin that burns easily and is prone to cancer. They are plagued with allergies and asthma. They cough, squeeze, and sneeze, and they broil in the inescapable sun. For Dick Kleberg, the dust, the pollen, and the cigarettes were too much. He developed emphysema, and his lungs began to fill with fluid. At first, he was only a step or two slower than in his prime, but then came hours at a time when he could not even go outside. A man who hated to be indoors, he was confined to his room, battling the disease that was smothering him. And then the hours became days, and the walls of his room became his world. When Bob Kleberg died, Dick should have at last been able to turn the daily grind of the ranch over to his cousins or sons and enjoy the status on which Bob had thrived. But his body would not let him. Several times he went into the intensive care unit at Spoon Hospital in Corpus Christi, and his family was told he was dying. But he rallied, returned home, and tried to work, only to become an invalid again. In the late spring of 1979, his favorite horse died, a mare named Anita Chica. It was like an omen, a member of the family recalled. A few weeks later, Dick Kleberg, 62 years old, was dead. The burial of the dead. It rained most of the morning, a rancher's dream. In Santa Gertrudis Creek, the narrow channel, scarcely a trickle, swelled slowly out toward the muddy banks. Along the wire mesh fences, latanias, horse mint, and ebony were beginning to bloom. The ranch's 563 employees, foremen, vaqueros, cooks, blacksmiths, farmers, secretaries, heavy equipment men, veterinarians, accountants, maids, stable boys, pilots, had gathered on the banks of the Santa Gertrudis. A festive tent had been erected for a family wedding scheduled the next day, but the crowds now converging on the King Ranch headquarters were there for a more solemn purpose. They were there to bury Dick Kleberg. The accidental conjunction of wedding and funeral seemed appropriate for such a cohesive family. One generation was passing, another was beginning. As the rain was bringing new life to the dry prairie, so the wedding would also bring new life to the ranch. The memorial service convened in the courtyard of Dick's house, a rambling, contemporary-style building laid out like one of the ranch's cow camp shelters. It nestles in a live oak grove next to the big house. The gentle, steady rain had turned the grass green and rich. Across Santa Gertrudis Creek, cattle grazed. Inside the courtyard, mariachis played the music of the border. The children perched on folding chairs, the girls in Easter dresses, the boys in neatly pressed suits. In the crowd were ranchers, Houston lawyers, South American diplomats, New York bankers. On the outskirts stood the ranch executives and foremen. Beyond them, hats in hand, the Quinenos stood awkwardly but proudly in their Sunday best. From behind the house emerged a procession of 14 Quinenos, each in khaki, each mounted on a rusty red King Ranch quarter horse. They lined up behind the swimming pool, their hats held over their hearts. In the center of this honor guard pranced a restless quarter horse without a rider, a yellow poncho draped over its saddle. The saddle was Dick's, made in the King Ranch saddle shop. Tied over it on either side were his boots. The sunlight flickering through the clouds reflected on the mother-of-pearl inlays in the handmade spurs. A plaintive trumpet solo signaled the beginning of the service. The rain had stopped, but the wind blew drops of water from the mesquite and live oak trees down onto the crowd. A young Episcopal priest spoke of how Dick had loved the land, had felt the promise of it, had worked it and suffered on it. Then the Quinenos priest gave a eulogy in Spanish. He talked about how the ranch people were workers and the Klebergs were patrones, but in death all were equal. The ranch workers, he added, addressing the family, had shared the family's joys and laughter, and today shared their sorrow and their tears. The mariachis played a polka, and the mounted Quinenos turned their horses and filed away, holding their hats to their sides in respect. The mourners began breaking up into smaller groups to tell stories far into the night about Dick, about the ranch, and about the other members of its family, like a Greek chorus telling tales of the deaths of kings. The family had been given much by the chance of birth, fame, riches, a vast ranch, but the funeral of Dick Kleberg was, above all, a reminder that they had also been given a ration of suffering. Two brothers. In the 5 years between the deaths of Bob and Dick Kleberg, the family endured more tumult, change, and confrontation than it had seen since the ranch partition in the 30s, if then. With Dick ill, the two most obvious heirs to the ranch were Dick's cousins B. Johnson and Robert Shelton. They were the sons of Bob Kleberg's star-crossed younger sister, Sarah. Sarah was one of the new breed of ranch women who were not content to stay primly indoors. She was most at home on the ranch, and when she married in 1928, she chose a young cowboy named Henry Belton Johnson. Before their first child, B, was two, his father was dead of a brain tumor. Sarah remarried the next year, this time to a Kingsville physician named Joseph Shelton. They had one son, Robert Richard, who was 6 years younger than his half-brother. In 1939, Dr. Shelton died, and in 1942, Sarah herself was killed in an automobile accident. Her two orphaned sons went to live with their grandmother, Alice King Kleberg, on the ranch. When she died in 1944 at the age of 82, they moved in with their Uncle Bob. Bob and Helen Kleberg raised Bee and Bobby like the sons they never had. Their daughter, Helenita, grew up with the two boys in that odd combination of wealth and simplicity typical of the ranch. They each had their own canyano servant, their own horses, their own cowboy suits, their own guns. They knew the significance of who they were. Yet they worked the roundups with the young canyanos, played with them, rode with them. Most ranch hands of our generation lived in town, Helenita recalls. We three grew up on the ranch. We spent our youth playing with canyanos. This was all pre-oil. The porch was screened then. There wasn't any air conditioning. We didn't have a pool, and I can remember my father's spraying us with the hose in the summers while we jumped up and down and squealed. We didn't have cars or radios or television the way kids do today. We had to entertain ourselves. The ranch was our playground. The old canyanos always had time to talk, and they would show us things. We'd walk down a path, and they'd know a use for every bush. This one would heal a wound. That one would cure a toothache. This one over here would make tea. Another one would make soap. My father was always telling us to become close observers, to notice details, and to draw conclusions from what we saw. Bee and Bobby grew up to be opposites, both in appearance and in personality. Bobby is short and scrappy, an endearing good old boy. After dabbling in college at A&M and UT, he went to work at the ranch in 1958. He helped with the breeding programs in South America, ran the Laurelis division, then became executive vice president of the ranch after Bob's death, and oversaw all of the domestic ranching operations. He is brash, opinionated, loyal, uncomplicated. I love the ranch, he said back in 1969. I like to play cowboy, and I don't mind working. A man of tremendous energies and a natural salesman, he would boast that he could sell anybody anything. He owned a Buick dealership in Kingsville, and when things got slow on the ranch, he'd go down and sell a few cars, just to keep in shape. B is tall and graceful, with the rosy complexion of an English beef eater. He was a young man of inner strength and drive, serious about his ambitions, willing to challenge his uncle on his own ground. After prep school, he studied agricultural economics at Cornell. He entered the Army at the end of the Korean War, then returned to attend the Stanford Business School. Bob Kleberg wanted nothing so much as for Bee to come back to the ranch and work with him. He took Bee along, for example, on his initial trip to Australia. When the ranch's first board of directors was formed in 1954, Bee, at 25, was by far the youngest member, just as Bob had been the youngest trustee following Mrs. King's death 30 years before. Bob put me in charge of the Santa Gertrudis division, the showplace of the ranch. But to be, being in charge meant being in charge. When Bob and Dick traveled around the Santa Gertrudis and gave orders to the foreman and the quinceañeros, as was their custom, B considered they had broken the chain of command. He had learned from the Army how a successful organization worked, and he never forgot his military lessons. If you gave a man responsibility, you had to give him authority. How could he run the ranch unless Bob or Dick went through him? But Bob Kleberg was not about to give up the absolute power he had always wielded. So in 1956, convinced that he could not continue to work in his uncle's shadow, B. Johnson, then 27, took his financial statement to the bank and borrowed enough money to buy the 70,000-acre Chaparosa Ranch southwest of Uvalde. No one since Captain King had ever done such a thing on his own. Bob saw this independence two ways. First, as a commendable sign of strength, confidence, and character, and second, as a direct challenge to his authority as head of the ranch and surrogate father. B remained an active member of the ranch's board, but he devoted the lion's share of his time to his own affairs. More than any other member of the family, B was the logical person to take over Bob's role after Dick became ill. He was the oldest male in the bloodline. He had studied at his uncle's knee and knew everything about ranching and the ranch. He was educated, diplomatic, polished. He even inherited the old man's boots, which he wears just as Bob did, with the trouser legs of the ubiquitous King Ranch tan twills tucked inside. Yet, when it came time to pick a successor to Bob Kleberg, the family did not call on B. Johnson to fill his boots, nor did they call on Bobby Shelton. Instead, they turned, as Captain King had almost 100 years before, to an outsider. The Outsider. In 1943, during the dark days of World War II, a tall and elegant young Army captain from Pennsylvania named James Clement married Ida Larkin, the daughter of Bob Kleberg's sister, Henrietta. The young man, a Princeton graduate, was from a prominent Eastern family. His father was the chairman of the Pennsylvania Railroad. Not long after the marriage, James Clement went back to war and was badly wounded in Normandy. After the war, the couple settled in New York. Clement's wounds were complicated by diabetes, and his physical weakness made him less than enthusiastic about the bitter labor battles that plagued the coal and railroad industries in the late 40s. With Bob's encouragement, he and Ida, who is known as Iya, moved to Kingsville in 1947. Jim Clement of Princeton and Philadelphia's main line went to work in the King Ranch office as the assistant office manager. His main duty was managing the inventories at the ranch's dry goods store and lumberyard. He was happy as could be, although Ilya missed New York. They moved into the big house and became occupied with the world of Kingsville and the ranch. Clement did not immediately make the transition to the relaxed style of the South Texas ranching aristocracy. One family member recalls that his somewhat stiff urbanity, so appropriate for New York City, clubs and boardrooms, seemed a little out of place in the mesquite brush. The young Clement started out to bring a bit of Eastern professionalism to the frontier informality of the ranch's operations. You couldn't see anybody without an appointment for the first few days, remembers a former ranch employee. But that didn't last long. Soon, Jim Clement was having coffee every morning at Harold's drugstore with the locals, soaking up gossip, being a part of things. But though he adapted to the rough, masculine casualness of the ranch, Jim Clement has never pretended to be what he is not. He is not at home in the saddle, and he can't look at a bull calf and pick out its breed type or use cowman's jargon to describe its beef conformation. He is more likely to wear topsiders and a pork pie hat than boots and a cowboy hat. He is a businessman rather than a rancher, and by being so different, he carved out a place for himself at the ranch that no one else in the family wanted. "We can leave that up to Jim," they said, as they saddled up to go out and work cattle. "Jim understands all that," they said as they loaded up to go hunting. "Ask Jim about figures," they said as they went off to pick out breeding calves. In other words, Jim Clement became indispensable. Bob Kleberg had kept the ranch running as a ranch. By sheer force of personality, he had given the impression that it could be run from the saddle, that running it was an art, an insight, a way of life. But during Bob's lifetime, the ranch became an increasingly complex business stretching all over the world. When Bob Kleberg would not return the lawyers' and accountants' phone calls, they talked to Jim Clement. And so did the family members who had moved away and had questions or needed help. Unlike his more robust relatives, to whom the indoors was almost a prison, Jim Clement was always in the office. It was not calculated. It was just that business was what Jim Clement did best. Who runs the ranch? The beginning of the ranch's recent history dates from the board meetings in 1974 to pick Bob Kleberg's successor. Dick Kleberg should have taken over, but even then his failing health would not let him. The board of directors was composed of two members from each branch of the family, the descendants of Bob and Richard Kleberg, and their sisters Henrietta and Sarah. They were Bob's daughter Helenita and her daughter Helencita, Richard's son Dick and Dick's son Tio, Henrietta's son-in-law Jim Clement and John Armstrong, and Sarah's sons, B. Johnson and Bobby Shelton. On the day of the board meeting in 1974, Bobby and B. each made a strong case that he should be named to the head ranch. Bobby based his claim on his determination to seek out better marketing approaches for the Santa Gertrudis breed, his plans for expanded oil and gas exploration, and his ability to come up with a reorganization of the ranch that would help the family's estate planning. B. based his case on his proven record and his commitment to maintaining the ranch's traditions. He was, he said, experienced and qualified, the logical choice. The magnitude of the decision was not lost on the board members. None of them had been alive the last time the family had picked a man to head the ranch, and now they would be deciding its future. The initial choice was basically either B or not B. Some of the directors resented the time and energy B had devoted to his own projects and the distance he had kept between himself and the ranch for the past few years. But the crucial factor was that he was a chip off the old block. If they picked B, they would be continuing the ranch as it was. They would be turning it over to a vigorous, confident man in the prime of his life, a man who was certain to give them, in his own words, exactly what they had with Uncle Bob, and more of it. The directors weren't at all sure that was what they wanted. As great a man as Bob Kleberg was, the longevity of his rule had stunted the growth of many members of the family. Perhaps, they thought, it would be better to have someone more like Dick, someone self-effacing and not so dominating. After a night of painful soul-searching, the question became, if not B, then who? Bobby had some support, but there was one man whom everybody trusted, a man who had not sought the leadership of the ranch and who did not expect to get it. His integrity was unquestioned, and as everyone knew, he did not have any personal ambition. He was a man who could be counted on to serve the ranch selflessly for as long as necessary, and then step aside, a man who, although he was not of the family, exemplified the seriousness and sobriety of Henrietta King and Robert Kleberg Sr., without the flamboyance or charisma of Richard King or Bob Kleberg. When the nominations were taken, John Armstrong immediately nominated Jim Clement. And then, to everyone's surprise, Dick Kleberg himself, who had kept his own counsel, seconded the nomination. Dick was the chairman of the board of the King Ranch, and with Bob gone, the titular head of the family. If he wanted Jim Clement, then Jim Clement it would be. There were no other nominations. Jim Clement was elected unanimously. To everyone's recollection, he had not said a single word throughout the 2 days. He simply accepted what had been given to him and went back to his office. There was a feeling, one family member says, that perhaps B would stay and mellow a little, or that Bobby would come along and that one of them would take over from Jim. B. Johnson knew, however, that it was one thing to be part of a ranch run by a brilliant, well-renowned rancher like Bob Kleberg, and another thing entirely to be part of a ranch run by a laconic businessman like Jim Clement. B. decided to sell out and go his own way, as the Easts had done 2 decades before. The irony, of course, is that B. Johnson could have done well as head of the ranch. All of his life had been spent preparing for it. But if his ability to run the ranch was not questioned, his willingness to allow the rest of the family to get their hands on it certainly was. That the rest of the family thought him too much like Bob Kleberg is understandable. He was a good deal like him. But Bob Kleberg, at 22, got the chance to run the big ranch, and once he got hold of it, he didn't let go for 56 years. B. Johnson never had the same chance. Paying the Piper. B. Johnson's departure was the first important test for the new regime. As is the case with matters of this lofty financial level, the U.S. tax code defined the limits of choice. A cash settlement would have an unfortunate impact on the estate taxes of several key family members, since it would establish a high cash value for their holdings. But it would also wipe out a great deal of the ranch's accumulated earnings and thus help reduce the family's taxes when the oil royalties were distributed. Still, that was easier to contemplate than giving up the ranch's status as a private corporation, or worse, disturbing the ghosts of Richard King and Bob Kleberg by giving up part of the ranch. In a tense strategy session, Bobby Shelton, Leroy Denham Jr., and John Armstrong decided to offer B a cash deal. Not since Henrietta King died in 1925 had a price tag been put on the whole ranch, oil, cattle, and all. That was one thing the ranch's negotiators did not want to do, haggle. They went with their best offer, $70 million, which meant that the whole ranch was worth about $600 million. B. caucused with his advisors for 5 minutes, then came back in. "I'll take it," he said. To get the money, the ranch went to Texas Commerce Bank in Houston. Instead of borrowing only enough to buy B's stock, the ranch made the amount to around $100 million, with the extra money going to finance the new drilling ventures with Shell, Chevron, and other oil companies. The debt was transferred into long-term loans with 2 insurance companies. Those loans had as collateral a portion of the ranch's oil royalties and also the ranch itself. For the first time since 1933, the 825,000 acres of the ranch, its windmills, stock pens, swimming pools, quinceañeros, cottages, and even the big house, were mortgaged. While all these negotiations were going on, the price of natural gas and oil were skyrocketing. In 1972, 1,000 cubic feet of natural gas had brought 30 cents. In 1976, the price was over $2. The ranch's great reserves of oil and gas, however, were running out. Petroleum experts predicted that the flow would slow to a trickle in the 1990s. But before the ranch's fields dried up, they entered a period of great production called a blowdown. This surge, coupled with the high prices, meant that suddenly the ranch was swimming in money. Royalties shot up from $20 million in 1970 to $100 million or so in 1979. In theory, the ranch could have followed Bob Kleberg's gospel and plowed the oil money back into ranching. Not everyone was for that approach. For years, some family members had fought a futile battle to get Bob Kleberg to pay out more of the ranch's royalties in dividends. He always refused, saying, "You've got too much already." One veteran of those skirmishes recalls, "He wanted us to stay tough and hardy, like our cattle. He didn't want us to have it easy and become soft. I think he was more afraid, deep down, of what the oil money could do to us than he was of Drell." But not even Bob Kleberg could have easily diverted so much wealth into cattle. And after his death, the foreign operations no longer had a strong champion. There was no one looking for new empires. Then, too, the gusher of money created serious tax problems. The wealth of the family was locked up in the ranch. On paper, they were well off, but actually, if one of them died, his heirs would be hard-pressed to pay the estate taxes. So in 1977, the ranch decided to distribute 75% of its oil and gas royalties to the individual family members, thus allowing each to invest his own share while the money lasted, without having to account to anyone. At the same time, without the responsibility of having to manage so much royalty income, the ranch's leadership could concentrate on what it did best, ranching. No longer would the oil money cover up any mistakes, so the pressure to make ranching pay would be intense. As a far-flung business, the King Ranch is no longer the simple agricultural operation Captain King handled with his own ledger books. It needs a man like Jim Clement with his legions of lawyers, accountants, and management consultants. More and more, the real work of the ranch is not done on horseback. It's done where Jim Clement works, behind a desk. Clement is the ranch's president and runs the larger corporate affairs of the ranch. In next in command, with primary responsibility for the foreign operations and for the ranch's larger public role, is John B. Armstrong. Armstrong and Clement married sisters, the daughters of Bob Kleberg's sister, Henrietta. Armstrong, a vigorous 60, is still a world-class polo player. He comes from a neighboring ranching family whose roots run as deep in South Texas as the Klebergs. His grandfather was first sergeant of the small band of McNally's Rangers that won the cattle wars and saved Captain King's cattle empire. A few years later, his grandfather captured John Wesley Hardin and invested the reward in a ranch wedged between the Narayas and Encino divisions of the King Ranch. John Armstrong's brother Tobin, who is married to former Ambassador Ann Armstrong, runs the Armstrong Ranch. As chairman of the Texas Animal Health Commission, Armstrong recently won acceptance from both government and cattlemen of the most controversial program in modern ranching history, the campaign to rid the state of cattle disease called brucellosis. A campaign as far-reaching and as unpopular to cattlemen as was Robert Kleberg's drive to wipe out Texas fever. The oil operations are handled by W.B. Yarborough, the husband of Dick's sister Catherine. He and T.O. Kleberg are the ranch's two vice presidents. T.O. oversees the four Texas divisions, the original ranch. Other family members have their own duties and serve on the management committee that monitors ranch policy, but these four men are in charge. Almost a three-decade span in ages separates Clement, Armstrong, and Yarborough from Teo's generation. Palpable evidence of the gap in leadership left when Dick died and B. and Bobby departed. The younger brother. Unlike B., Bobby stayed with the ranch a while, helping to negotiate the ranch's financing and its new drilling projects. But it soon became apparent that Bobby, who was a fountain of ideas, wasn't selling his family on very many of them. He wanted to set up the ranch as a limited partnership, with himself as the leader of a small group of general partners. He opposed the royalty distribution. He pushed for Santa Gertrudis dealerships near the major population centers to market cattle like ours. To Bobby, the family was maddeningly difficult to push to a decision, and it appeared that Jim Clement, far from being an interregnum, Pope John, as he refers to himself, would be in charge indefinitely. And so in 1977, Bobby decided to leave the ranch. It could not have been an easy decision. He had spent years building a sprawling house for himself and his growing family on a rise opposite the big house, right next to Highway 141. It was a symbol, clear and unmistakable, that he was at the ranch to stay. Today, that house stands empty, a monument to the frailty of human ambition. When he left, Bobby moved his own ranching empire to a ranch near Kerrville that he bought as his headquarters. He's building another house there. He's the biggest thing to come through Kerrville since the Guadalupe, one local rancher says. His departure, however, was on somewhat different terms than that of his half-brother. Instead of getting cash, Bobby got land and other assets in Texas and Florida. When that deal was settled, it appeared that the ranch had concluded a fairly difficult passage, the equivalent of the partitioning of 1935 and the East's departure in 1958. But when B learned what Bobby had gotten, something didn't seem quite right. There was in Bobby's deal a reference to an Exxon claim. There had been no mention of that during his negotiations. When he realized what was at stake, Johnson was thunderstruck. It appeared to him that the ranch, his family, had concealed the possibility that Exxon underpaid the ranch by as much as $300 million between 1973 and 1976, a period when gas prices sextupled. If Exxon really did owe the ranch that money, B believed he had been denied his fair share of the income from it, as much as $35 million. After some negotiating with the ranch, B filed suit in federal court in San Antonio in June 1979. He charged that the ranch had told him nothing of the Exxon claim, which he says it was investigating at the same time it was negotiating a settlement with him. He also charged that once the ranch realized how much money might be involved, it changed its negotiating strategy and offered to buy him out for cash, depriving him of any portion of a future settlement from Exxon. With the exception of a tersely worded response to B's allegations that denied virtually every charge, the ranch's testimony had been sealed by the court. This case is still pending. Jim Clement gave his deposition in April. As far as anyone can tell, the ranch's position is that B was much too closely involved in the ranch not to know about the Exxon claim. In any case, the ranch believes that B forfeited his claim on any future income from the ranch when he sold his stock. That B's deal did not include a future interest in the Exxon claim, while Bobby's did, only showed how different the two deals were. Bobby got assets. B got cash. A deal was a deal. Dick's sister, Alice Meyer, who sold out for cash a year after B did, isn't suing the ranch over the Exxon claim. Why should B? In late October 1979, when the statute of limitations on the Exxon claim was about to expire, Bobby Shelton, who still owns 11.2% of the ranch's royalty income, stepped in and sued the ranch and Exxon. But while B's suit alleges deception, Bobby's accuses the ranch of mismanagement. He claims that the ranch has botched the Exxon claim and therefore has failed to fulfill its responsibilities to the royalty owners, who, since 1977, have been the family members. His patience with what was, to his mind, the plodding, indecisive, and timid style of the new management was exhausted. If the ranch wasn't going to get after the Exxon claim, then by God, he would. Through all this heat and smoke, the ranch continued to negotiate quietly with Exxon. It rejected a $33 million settlement and proposed instead that Exxon increase the ranch's royalties on future gas sales from a sixth to a fifth. The ranch basically believes that such matters are nothing that gentlemen can't solve. After all, Bob Kleberg always insisted on treating the humble executives with the same trust, deference, and neighborly spirit that the ranch showed his fellow ranchers, and to sue a neighbor would be unthinkable. When Bobby left, he agreed that the ranch would handle the humble lease, and the ranch contends that it is doing so at its own speed. In fact, this summer, the ranch and Exxon compromised on a higher royalty payment, a large step towards settling the Exxon claim. But the value of that settlement is considerably less than Bee and Bobby contend it should be, and will not likely end their suits. Not since the Atwood suits has the ranch had so many legal entanglements. The Crown Prince in Exile. B. Johnson's Chaparosa Ranch lies near Uvalde, 160 miles northwest of the King Ranch. It is a rugged, functional, but now drought-ridden place. Everything B. learned from Bob, he has put into practice there. Since he left the King Ranch, B. has devoted his considerable talents and energies to his own affairs. He is on the boards of numerous companies, including AT&T, U.S. Trust, Tenneco, and First City Bank Corp. He is developing the landmark Hyatt Regency Hotel, a block away from the Alamo in San Antonio, a stone's throw from where his grandfather died a century ago. He is also probably the single most talented breeder in Santa Gertrudis show cattle in the world. Starting from scratch, he has built a string of animals that sweep many major shows. He has won Grand Champion at Houston, for example, 5 years in a row. In fact, many people believe that B's cattle would give the King Ranch's foundation herd a good run for its money if the ranch were to drop its policy of not competing. It feels there are better standards by which to judge good cattle. His Santa Gertrudis auction now rivals the King Ranch's. B still has a strong sense of belonging to the King Ranch family. In 1964, he and his wife Patsy began an annual summer camp, a tradition that more than any single thing could keep that family together. "The 13 of us in my generation were all close," he recalls, "but the next generation just didn't know each other. Bob's wife Helen had done more than anyone to sustain the family. When she died in 1963, there was a vacuum. So we started a summer camp to bring the next generation together and make the traditions of the ranch real. Tio's generation, the ones taking over the ranch now, were our first campers, and today they're running the camp themselves. If you ask them where they first learned how strong their family really is, they'll tell you it was at summer camp." The ranch is still in his blood. B has acquired, through his purchase of La Puerta de Agua Dulce Ranch from the King family, Captain King's original brand, the HK, for Henrietta King. His loyalty to the ranch and his family is unwavering. In spite of the separation and the lawsuit that followed, he will not make a single negative statement about any of them. "They are my family," he says. "They mean a great deal to me, no matter what happens." Something about B, however, is slightly out of scale. In spite of the magnitude and complexity of his projects, he seems somehow to be playing on too small a stage. Perhaps the family did make a mistake, for both his and their sake, when they did not choose him to succeed Bob Kleberg. Yet, on his own, away from the family, B is free of the constant compromising and diplomacy that would have been necessary if he had run the ranch. Most of the time, he believes he's better off. But one day last winter, flying high over his ranch in one of his airplanes, B. Johnson, an immensely successful businessman in his own right, a man of intelligence, personality, and charisma, had the King Ranch on his mind. He unfolded a letter that Will Rogers had written to him when his father died, back when B. was only 1 year old, and read it aloud to a friend. The letter reflects on what the ranch meant, who his parents were, and who B is. When he finished the letter, there were tears in his eyes. Meanwhile, back at the ranch. Despite the squabbles, the oil wealth, and the lawsuits, the family survives, and so does the reality of 825,000 acres of South Texas. From the southernmost fences at Norias, which run right into the Laguna Madre just north of Port Mansfield, to the upper limits of the Laureles on the outskirts of Corpus Christi, 93 miles north, the King Ranch is still a ranch. In dollars, the ranching operations may be dwarfed by the oil income. In acres, the Texas land may be lost in the vastness of the foreign holdings. But here, on land so flat and undistinguished that one can feel instantly disoriented and lost, here is where the heart of the family still is. The nuts and bolts of the four home ranching divisions, Santa Gertrudis, Norias, Laureles, and Encino, are now Tio Kleberg's responsibility as a vice president of the ranch. Tio has worked full-time at the ranch since 1971, when he and Janelle moved back to Kingsville from El Paso, where Tio had been an Army lieutenant at Fort Bliss. "I went to see Uncle Bob about a job," Tio recalls, "and he told me I would be working for my dad. All my dad did was look at me and say, 'Go to work.' I got $400 a month and a Chevrolet Bel Air. I threw my saddle in the trunk and headed out to work cattle. We were in a tick quarantine, so we were moving herds all day, every day. We hadn't even moved into our house, and all our things were still in boxes. I spent my summers on the ranch growing up, so I had a good idea of what to do. But it was hard at first, knowing that men who knew a lot more than I did would be watching me. But I couldn't have been happier. I wanted to be a rancher since I was a kid. I've never wanted to do anything else." What he wanted to become, he is. Today he drives a Chevrolet Suburban filled with ranching and hunting paraphernalia. He lives and breathes cattle and horses. Even at night and on weekends, he's prepared for one of the ranch employees to show up on his doorstep with a problem. If anything goes wrong at the ranch, from a leaky pipe to a sick relative to a hurricane, Tio is off to fix it. Given the complexity and size of the business, much of his time is spent in the office. But like Bob and Dick Kleberg before him, Tio Kleberg is most at home outdoors. He is a determined, magnetic leader who works as hard himself as he expects the ranch employees to work. He has developed, of necessity, a good sense of diplomacy. To run the ranching operations of the King Ranch requires different political skills than Bob Kleberg exercised. Bob owned 25% of the ranch. Tio has less than 2% of the stock, so he can't ride over the family like Bob did. He has to keep them happy. Tio also has courage. "The traditions of the ranch are great," Joe Stiles says, "but they'll kill this place if you let them." Tio's got the vision and the guts to get rid of the ones that don't work. One such tradition was the quarter horse program, which had become the fiefdom of the division foreman, with each foreman controlling his own breeding program. The only problem was that the horses weren't good enough. When Tio set out to improve the ranch's horses, he centralized the whole breeding operation and gambled $125,000 to buy Mr. San Pepe and add his blood to the line. There were protests, difficult scenes, and mutterings of discontent, but the management problem was only half of it. To change a breeding program is a serious risk, since the investment is great and it takes years to see results. The results are coming in now, and Tio has been vindicated. As they were 40 years ago, the King Ranch quarter horses are today the envy of the business. An uncertain future. The changes since the death of Bob Kleberg are subtle but significant. The current management's objective is an agricultural operation designed to be self-sufficient and to produce a profit, which it did last year, as if the oil money did not exist. The ranch raises cotton and milo on 37,400 acres of the Santa Gertrudis and the Laureles, tended by an array of machinery that would rival the Russian tank corps. The Milo is processed at the ranch's own feed mill over on the Santa Gertrudis and used in its huge feedlot. The farms were put in a year or so before Bob's death. We'd just cross our fingers and hope that he wouldn't see them, Tio recalls. I've got a hunch he knew what we were doing, but had just decided not to say anything, to give us a shot at it, even though he knew we knew he hated farming. The largest piece of Bob's Australian empire, the almost 4 million acre leasehold at Brunette Downs, was recently sold to an Australian syndicate. As a result, the ranch now runs about 4.3 million acres overseas, compared to 8.6 million in 1978. The rest of the foreign operations are barely to make moderately profitable, but the family decided that the tremendous effort required to complete Bob Kleberg's plans for the Australian outback was simply not worth the candle. Very quietly, the new management of the ranch has announced the beginning of an era of limits, of pulling the fences back to what they can manage and afford. It's a vision far less expensive than Bob's, but it is one they believe they can handle. It is too soon to tell whether they are right. They have already crossed some major hurdles, buying out Bee and Bobby, distributing the oil and gas royalties, selling off the largest foreign operation, reinstituting farming. On the surface, the ranch appears to be headed for greener pastures, but the future may bring some thorny problems. One family member still with the ranch put it this way: "Sure, we're better off individually now that the oil money is coming out to us, but what about the ranch? What happens if we have a truly severe drought, or if the bottom falls out of the cattle market? The oil money was the ranch's cushion, and it also gave it the capital to experiment and be innovative. That's how we've kept it going. Without the oil money, I'm not at all sure we'll be so successful." And although the family now seems unified, time may work against them. Jim Clement is not in his best of health, and no one knows how the ranch will be run when he and John Armstrong lay down the reins. Every 20 years since the 30s, first with the Atwoods, then the Easts, then recently Bee and Bobby, the family has had to confront itself and its individual and collective ambitions before moving on. A decade from now, that confrontation will likely occur again. Everyone in the family seems very happy with Tio as the boss of the Texas ranches, but they also have grown too fond of their own roles to want anyone, at least for the present, to run the ranch single-handedly, the way Bob Kleberg did. And so a new era has begun, one of collective leadership, not as responsive, decisive, or visionary as one man could be, but more representative of the family. The people most prominent in that collective leadership are bullish on the ranch, but they are not without their doubts. It's not at all a foregone conclusion that we'll make it, Tio mused. There's a lot working against a place like this. And there it is. The modern world heads the list. It is hardly hospitable to a frontier institution with a paternalistic system and an aristocracy joined by tradition to local, loyal vaqueros who spring from the same piece of earth. The modern world lures those vaqueros off the land and into the cities. It also tempts the family, seduces them away from the ranch with the endless possibilities for the use of their inheritance. If the next generation is content to live off their income, John Armstrong says, then we've lost it. On the other hand, there's also a lot working for a place like this. The ranch has been through hard times before. Ranchers expect that. The younger generation, although largely untested, could produce the visionaries and leaders the ranch's destiny will require. The family itself is the ranch's greatest resource. One of the children, perched precariously on his first horse, could be the next Bob Kleberg. History also is an ally. The ranch may survive into the next century because it survived into this one. No generation of the family wants to be the one that stood by and let the King Ranch fail. And at the core of that history is one simple, constant, endlessly repeated fact on this day, as on every day, there is work to be done.
That's all the time we have today for our series on the King Ranch, published from Texas Monthly Magazine. We'll have the conclusion of this article next week.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Noon Book Hour, followed by the Coronavirus Update at 1.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 44 and partly cloudy. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the low 30s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-40s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 30s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 12 noon.
It's time for the Noon Book Hour. Readings of books from all genres, handpicked by staff at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello and welcome back. I'm Tom Jowers for the Georgia Radio Reading Service. This is the third episode of Hercule Poirot's Christmas by Agatha Christie. I'm going to go back just a little bit to bring you up to date from our last reading. Tressilian's mind stopped with a jerk. Walter